Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today as we talk weeds and veggies with our two guests. One of them is Kevin Schesso. Kevin, the Agriculture Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Kevin, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks, Larry.
And Diana Alfeth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce Counties, our other guest. Diana, good to see you as well.
Always great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
So we'll talk with these two experts about the weeds you might be finding in your garden or lawn at this time of the year. We'll also look, as I said, at which vegetables you can plant now and harvest in the fall. So what plant questions are on your mind? Have you been having some trouble with weeds lately? Which are the most aggravating to you? Are you planting some vegetables right now and hoping to harvest in the fall? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@WPR.org. Diana, let's start with you. How bad a problem can lawn and garden weeds be at this time of the year?
Well, they love this hot weather. And I know that down in the southern part of the state, you got a lot of rain today and stuff. Over here in western Wisconsin, we're really dry. We got less than a half an inch in a lot of areas last night, and we're way below normal and in needed amounts here. But these weeds are called weeds for a reason, and they don't seem to care that they haven't been getting regular rain. So they're really becoming visible. They're becoming visible in lawns. And some of the big weeds like wild parsnip and giant ragweed are really taking over. And, you know, the biggest thing right now is when these weeds are big and mature like this, herbicides aren't really effective on them. Sometimes it's in a place that it's hard to mow them off, but anything that you can do to stop them from going to seed, because a lot of them are setting flowers and seeds right now, anything you can do to stop them from seeding out will make your life a whole lot easier next year and for years to come. And that's, in many cases, the biggest strategy we can do right now is to use a string trimmer, use a mower, use a hatchet, whatever you need to do to whack them off and not let them go to seed.
I guess that's the organic way.
That's right. That's right. And like I said, a lot of them, especially things like giant ragweed, well, that's an annual. So those plants are going to die at the end of the year once we get frost anyway. So nuking them with herbicides isn't really the best approach. But if you have perennial weeds, like things like Canada thistle or some other types of perennial weeds, herbicides are going to struggle to work on them right now. Even things like Creeping Charlie, it just laughs at herbicides at this time of the year. So if you can just hang on and wait till fall around Labor Day, the herbicides are much more effective on those perennial weeds, and you can try to clear them out for next year.
Yeah, I was thinking about Canada thistle. That's tough any time of the year to get rid of.
It is.
It is indeed. Kevin, let me shift to you for a minute to talk about vegetables. If you're looking to harvest some this fall, what can we be planting in our gardens right now?
Well, sure. Well, I just want to say this is my absolute most favorite time of the gardening season, because we are in the throes of, you know, getting to enjoy all the work we did months ago. But we also need to think about how we can extend that harvest and that, I guess, joy of getting to work with plants well into the fall, if that's what we would like to do. So there's any number of plants right now that we can think about seeding right now in preparation for having something to harvest in the fall. And I'm a big fan of container gardening. I do an awful lot of it on my deck right outside my sliding glass door. I just step out and I've got about 8 different containers with any number of different plants in them. And a lot of those plants are those ones that we can rotate and seed more than once during the growing season. And those, of course, being your lettuce and radish and spinach You could even plant kale right now if you wanted to get a little bit of that going. Peas, it's not too late to do beans. You know, again, you have to keep in mind your growing season, your growing conditions, and if there's enough time to mature the plant to see that harvest. But out in the ground gardening, I'm going to be doing some summer seeding of carrots here shortly, just so I have that opportunity to have a nice fall crop of carrots. I'm actually going to do it after I harvest my garlic, which is in about 2 weeks. And it's a little stretch to get it to mature, but it, you know, if you're short on space, you can, you know, do double cropping in a traditional in-ground garden in some cases as well. So lots of options. I'm even going to be starting some basil and some more cilantro. Sometimes those bolt and go to seed, you know, and if you want to have a nice lush fall crop of basil, you know, if you get on it and you start your seeds right now, you put them in a small enough container, you can bring that basil inside come fall. So lots of options if you're so inclined to, you know, start more plants and keep that garden season going well into fall.
That sounds great. Well, we have Chris in Milwaukee with a question, so let's go there. Chris, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about hostas. I heard about a virus or some kind of disease that seems to be ravaging them that I think mine are all infected. And I was just at the point where I was thinking about splitting them this year and spraying them around the house in the backyard. They've been really thriving, but they have the leaves kind of bleached out on the tips and then they turn brown. And it seems like this is indicative of this hosta virus that's going around. I heard that the cure for this is to tear them out, take out the dirt, you know, sanitize your tools, like all of this. It seems like a lot for my.
Yeah, it seems like a lot. Well, let's hear what Diana. Do you want to take that?
Sure. So the virus that you're probably talking about is called Hostavirus X, and it is a virus that gets into the plant, usually spread by insects or some other kind of mechanical way. Once a plant has a virus, you cannot cure it. You cannot remove the virus from the plant. So if you suspect that you have Hostavirus X, the best thing to do is to get rid of that plant. Now, the virus doesn't actually like live in the soil or anything like that. So you don't have to worry about that too much. And again, viruses don't blow in the wind like fungal spores do. They usually need an insect to transmit it from one plant to another. And that insect would feed on the infected plant. So that insect's not going to like feed in the soil and get it or anything like that. But first thing is that you really should make sure that you actually have Hostavirus X, because the virus doesn't usually show up as bleached tips or brown spots. That sounds a little bit more maybe like sun scorch or heat injury or drought injury or something else. The virus usually shows some kind of like mottling, like maybe some yellowing spots or some creamy colored spots or distorted leaves, things like that. So the first thing before you decide to get rid of all of your hosta would be a definite diagnosis. And really the only way to do that is to send a sample into the disease diagnostics clinic and they can test for it. Because again, the symptoms vary and visually you can suspect it, but you can't confirm it. So if you have a bunch of them that you want to spread around, I'd get it tested first to make sure that's what you're dealing with.
So just go online to the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. They'll give you instructions on how to send that sample in, Chris. There you go. Thanks so much for that question. Linda in Oregon couldn't stay with us. She called but couldn't stick around. She's battling vine squash borers and wants some advice to fight them, and wonders as well, is it too late to season in the season to plant zucchini? And she's in southern Wisconsin in Oregon, Kevin.
Certainly summer squash, it's much shorter season than our winter varieties. So I would say if your plants look like they're not worth keeping and they're just too, infected with the vine squash borer, you could plant again. I don't see why not. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. And maybe you can select or find a variety that's a little shorter seasoned. You can find that on the seed packet. So I would go ahead and think about replanting.
And what do you do? Not? Yeah. Is there any way to, once they're in there, the squash borers, they're much.
That's so true because the moths will, they lay their eggs at the base of the plant and those eggs, as soon as they hatch, they burrow into the stem. And now they're kind of secluded and the birds and anybody else who might want to, get to them, including the gardener, you have to literally cut the stem open. And so they're quite invasive and they can do a lot of damage. And once you got them, you certainly can try to kill them while they're in there. And there's probably spray products or different insecticides that you could maybe that are labeled for that. I'd have to double check what those might be. But for the most part, preventative stuff is it's too late for that. So, unless you can get in there, squish them and kill them, they're probably going to keep doing their thing and the plant is not going to be happy. So, this stage of the game, you probably
tough.
Have to.
Yeah.
Count your losses and try the replanting.
Diana, sure. Anything to add?
Yeah, and actually planting a second planting of summer squash in early July can be pretty effective because those adult moths that are laying these eggs, their population tends to decrease after the middle of July. And so these later plants tend to be less affected by it. But another thing that some people have had some success with is, as Kevin mentioned, they lay their eggs usually at the base of the plant near the root system. And so some people will put something there to physically exclude the moths. So things like floating row cover or like bridal veil kind of material. And you could just kind of like crunch it up and kind of cover up those stems. Some people have used tin foil, but you have to be careful you don't damage the stems. But anything down near that base where they want to access and lay their eggs can help you have less damage, at least with that. So you might want to try that. But if you can plant some summer squash right now, again, as Kevin mentioned, look at your growing season and plant a quick maturing variety so that you can get them to production before, we never know when our first frost and cold weather will come. It makes it a little hard, but I would definitely give it a try.
All right. Our guest today, Kevin Chesso, Ag Development Educator for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, and Diana Alfeth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Tyler Ditter's our engineer today. Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guests from UW Extension, Kevin Chesso and Diana Alfeth. Let's take another call. By the way, you could join in. There's an open line or two for you at 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Louise in Dodgeville, we'll go to you now. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about Kentucky bluegrass and actually killing it off. We want to winter seed like over the snow for some prairie plants. So I'm wondering what is the best time? Should we be trying to kill it now or in the fall? And what do you recommend for killing it? Should we cover it? I'd prefer not to use a ton of Roundup on it, but just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, go, Diana, do you want to take that?
Sure. So Kentucky bluegrass is a great lawn grass, and you can plant it by sod because it has all those rhizomes and stolons that knit it together. But that's also what makes it spread, and that's also what makes it similar to quackgrass, hard to get rid of if you want to get rid of it. So depending on the size of the area, you do have a couple of options. One option would be like tilling it up and then tilling it up and then tilling it up. And those roots and rhizomes that are down in the soil, they will continue to want to spread. So one tilling doesn't do it because they'll sprout back up. But if you had the ability to work the area up like every week and finally starve out those little roots that are left in there, you could get rid of it. And I would start that now, because if you're going to be doing seeding over winter, you want that bluegrass all dead by fall. If you don't get it all dead, it's going to start growing in your prairie planting, and it's going to take over. It's going to outcompete your prairie plantings, especially because prairie seeds typically take 2 years to really get established because they're just growing that root system. And in the meantime, that bluegrass can outcompete them and choke it out. Your other option, as far as covering it goes, that can work, but you need to have it covered fully in the dark for probably at least 8 weeks, if not longer, because those roots, again, have a lot of energy in them, and that will, you know, they'll try to survive. So that is an option. And again, I do that now because you want it fully dead by fall. And if you go to like winter seeding, those seeds need to have soil contact. So you can't just let those seeds lay on top of the dead bluegrass because they won't germinate. They need to actually have the soil. So once that bluegrass is dead, you need to work it up somehow, at least a little bit, to get some soil exposed for your prairie seeds to land on it and be able to germinate next spring. And then the other option, and probably the most effective and easiest, is going to be glyphosate to kill it off. And you can do that at any time. Typically, when you spray glyphosate, in a case like this, if you're getting ready for a prairie, I would spray it. You have to wait about 2 weeks before the stuff is actually going to die. And then little things are going to try to grow back. So you need to do a second spraying. And then again, you need to work up that soil a little bit, at least to be able to have soil exposed for those seeds to come in contact with to germinate. So those are kind of your options. And it kind of, again, depends on your situation, your resources, and how big the area is.
If I might add another option, you know, as Diana said, none of this is simple. I mean, you've got a very long-lived perennial that's well-established, assuming it's been a lawn for a while. And to get all those roots killed is going to take some time and effort. So time and effort is just the name of the game here. But one of the things we have done in the past here at our teaching and display garden at the Spooner Ag Research Station, when we went in and did some renovating in established sod, and we wanted to get a garden in, you know, right away, we rented a sod cutter. Now, again, it's a ton of work, but you can rent these machines, and they got a little cutter bar, and they go over the turf and they cut it at the root, and you kind of roll it up. It's like the opposite of installing turf, but you know, you now have this rolled up turf that you can, you know, stack somewhere or move it to another part of your property if you want, or give it to your neighbor and they can resod some part of their lawn. But that's just another option. It's a little bit labor intensive, but it does.
It works.
Get you through that bare soil. Yeah,
it works. There you go, Louise. Thank you so much for calling. Linda called back to ask if there were any more preventive measures for vine squash borers. Preventive measures.
Well, you know, I mean, prevention is involves things like don't plant your vine crops in the same place, because these adults will overwinter in the soil really close to the plants from last year. So rotation helps some. Working up the soil, isn't always, we kind of like no-till methods and for the health of the soil, not working the soil a lot. But if you do that late in the season or early in the season, that will kill some of the overwintering insects by bringing them to the surface. There's only one generation a year, and they come out in late spring, early summer. And that's, of course, when they're really laying their eggs. And so row covers, if you put row covers over those plants when they're out laying their eggs, that's prevention. But you have to, of course, get those row covers off once you've got blossoms going so that the bees and other pollinators can get in there, unless you're going to go in with your paintbrush and do it. So prevention is a little challenging. There are some, insecticides that you can do, but culturally and physically excluding them is probably your best prevention.
Sharon in Berlin, we'll go to you. Sharon, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have had something happen in our garden this year that's never happened before to our memory. Anyway, and that's pretty long. I'm 82. Anyway, we think it's from the heat. And the watering that we had at the beginning of the spring was so hot. But we have leaves curling and turning white around the edges.
And this is on flowers. Is this flowers or veggies or?
Squash, double mock orange.
So flowers and veggies. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. What do you think? Probably the weather.
Yeah, I hate to say when in doubt, blame it on the weather, but in some cases like this, I think you're right in line there. If you're getting it on multiple species, multiple types of plants like this, it probably is some kind of scorch, some kind of drought. Like you said, that heat that we had early on really did some damage. We've seen a lot of curling of leaves and that sort of thing. But we shouldn't discount anything else, too. So, for example, if there was any chance of herbicide drift back when these plants were first unfurling, that can cause these symptoms. Sometimes if people have tried to spray a fungicide or an insecticide, that might have damaged the foliage. So if there's anything weird like that happened, we could look at that as well. But it does sound like weather and heat related symptoms.
Yeah. Sharon, thank you.
I would tend to agree. But, again, there's always, and like I've said before, Larry, you got to do your horticulture CSI and start thinking back about what these plants have seen and weather and weather related things come and go, and sun scald and leaf injury is very common because of non-organisms. We call them abiotic stresses, and could even be fertility. It could be ozone. It could be, heat, drought, all those things. So I guess you have to just think about what those plants have seen, and maybe there's a bit of an answer there.
Yeah, absolutely. Sharon, thanks again for calling. Glenn in Waterford, we'll turn to you. Hi, Glenn.
Yeah, hi there. We have a 4x4 raised bed garden, and we have 64 blue maize corn planted there. And the corn is tall. It looks pretty healthy and so on. It tasseled several weeks ago. But on the stalks, we only find only a couple stalks that have the ears starting. And I just wondered, is that normal? Is it just to wait for them, or is there something we can do? It doesn't look like all of them have ears forming.
Did you see silks come out down there where the ears were supposed to be? Were there silks at one point?
The silks, no silks.
No silks. just the tassels on top.
Okay.
What was the variety of the corn again?
It's blue maize. It's that blue maize corn.
Okay.
And is that an heirloom, open pollinated variety, I'm assuming?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think it is, Kevin.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, sometimes open pollinated varieties, because they are open pollinated, they can have a lot of genetic variability. I wouldn't think, you know, being barren, meaning no silks or ear parts, would be one of those common variabilities. But, you know, that's something at least to consider. But I guess.
So.
Yeah, I'm not sure why there's no ears.
So one of the questions I have is, you said it's a 4x4 raised bed and you have 64 plants in there, which means each plant is only got about 8 inches radius around it. And I'm wondering if that's just such competition that those plants are too stressed, because typically you plant corn, you know, in rows, and they can be 8 inches apart within the row, but you need a foot and a half or so at least between rows, because those, you know, those roots need their space and everything. So if there's not light getting in down where those silks and ears should form, because the plants are planted so close together, maybe that's what's going on.
Yeah, it could well be. Yeah. Yeah, that's something to consider, Glenn. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Well, let's turn to Shirley in Moreno. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. I have two questions. One is regarding the hostas that gentleman was talking about. Ours, too, we had that really hot weather in early June. And I was wondering, is there any other reason than just for looks to get rid of those sun-scald, well, if it is sun-scald, leaves on your plants? Does it weaken the plant or?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't weaken the plant. I mean, obviously that brown tissue is not doing photosynthesis. It's not feeding the plant, but it's not drawing anything out of the plant either. Now, you could make the argument that, okay, it's dead plant material and it's just going to die and rot, but the fungi that typically decompose dead tissue don't usually affect live tissue. So it's mostly a cosmetic thing at this point, and whether or not it bothers you to look at it.
Yeah, there you go, Shirley. Thank you. Dan in Westby, on to you now. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry. Dan Small here. I wanted to chime in on the squash vine borer situation.
Yeah, Dan.
My wife raises winter squash, and we store it all year, and we eat it all year. We're still eating last year's squash. And she has over 200 hills of squash out there in the field right now. We use the same field year after year. And for the mature plants or the growing plants, if the vine borers show up, we use a product called Thuricide. It's Bacillus thuringiensis, otherwise commonly known as BT. It's available at garden stores. And you inject it into the base of the stem with a syringe. You have to follow instructions on how to mix the stuff. And if there are borers there already, and you can see them by the holes that they leave, and sometimes they're, you know, there's some little crumbly matter of the vine. If you take a syringe and bend the tip, or take a real fine knitting needle, what do?
It's a bent tip syringe.
Okay.
You got to hook them out.
A syringe with a bent tip. You can actually reach in there and hook them out of the hole, because there's usually only one per hole. And the best thing, though, that we found in the last couple of years is a homeopathic remedy that we get from homeopathyplus.com. And it's got a longer name, but if you just look up Bombyx, B-O-M-B-Y-X, it's a homeopathic remedy that you spray once a year on the very tiny plants as they come up, and we have no vine borers on any of those plants. It's just remarkable. I will send you a link to that website so that people can call in and get it if they want it.
Oh, Dan Small, thank you so much. We can even post that. Have you guys thinking about Bombix? Diana, have you heard of that?
I have not, so I would be curious to know what the active ingredient in that is.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, we can post that up on our today's notes, today's date. Go to the ideas at WPR.org/Larry. We can put that up. Once Stan sends us the link, we can put that link up on our page under program notes. Dan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Listener called, couldn't stay with us. They have a blue spruce dying at the top of the tree. That's dying up at the top. And, you know, wondered if you might know what's going on.
I think Diane's the expert on this. I heard her give a presentation not too long ago about diagnosing tree issues, and she did a wonderful job.
All right, Diana, what do you got?
Well, typically when we have a tree that's dying at the top, then there's something that's preventing water from getting from the roots to the top of the tree. And it starts at the top normally because that's the farthest place from the root, so the farthest that the water has to transport to. So then the question is, it goes back to Kevin's horticulture CSI thing, is to figure out what's stopping that water from getting up to the top of the tree. So step number one is to look at the trunk, especially just below where the dead stuff is, see if there's any kind of damage up there. You know, there could have been storm damage. If the tree is smaller, we're looking at any kind of damage to the trunk, any injury, old, you know, wound from being, you know, whacked by the lawnmower, whatever, that kind of a thing. If we don't find anything like that, we're looking at, like, if there's a double leader and those two leaders have kind of outcompeted and killed them off. We're looking at anything in the area that might have damaged the roots. So if there was any construction in the area in the last 5 years, you know, trenching, a new patio, anything like that. We're looking at just how big of a area that tree has for a root system to begin with. If it's in a little spot between a lot of cement and pavement or buildings and stuff, and it has a small root system, then maybe we're simply looking at drought. So we had a lot of drought throughout the year throughout the state last year, and we're seeing that show up on trees this year because there was some damage to that vascular system and the root system. And so it's really, really hard to say, but typically when it's in a pattern like that where it's just at the top of the tree, we are not looking at a disease or insect. That's at least not in a spruce tree. And a deciduous tree like an ash or a maple, there is a fungus called verticillium that plugs up the vascular system, but I don't believe that affects spruce trees at all. So it's probably something abiotic, environmental, that caused it, and we'd really have to dig into it individually more to see if we could figure it out.
All right, there you go. Let's turn to Deb. I've got one here that I think Kevin might want to, well, maybe both of you. Deb in Plymouth emailed, she often finds garden carrots to be bitter, wonders if there's a variety you recommend planting at this time of the year, or any other ideas you might have about why she gets bitter carrots.
Yeah, I think, you know, plants produce all kinds of defense compounds, and you know, if the carrots are under stress, they can get that bitter taste to them. So, I mean, it could just be the condition of the soil or the environment that might give carrots that off flavor. So I would, you know, just think about that. You know, what kind of soil are they growing in? Obviously, if they're not looking healthy and growing nice and vigorous, that would be an indication that the, you know, there's some stress there. So that might cause that off flavor. Sometimes if they get too mature, if they, you know, just like a lot of produce, they have this peak ripeness period. But if you plant this time of year and you wait till fall and they go through some of that freeze, you know, when, after a frost, because the, you know, carrots will grow well into the fall, you know, that oftentimes will cause carrots to be sweeter because of that fall chilling they go through. So maybe, you know, you could make adjustments to your planting timing or take a look at your soil. In regards to individual varieties, you know, I'm sure there's some varieties that are going to be touted to be sweeter and better. And I'm sure that's the case, you know, storage versus, you know, fresh picked, you know, eating carrots. You would think are bred to be a little bit more flavorful. There's lots and lots of different varieties to choose from. And it's just a matter of looking at the plant description, you know, whether or not they're really noted to be sweet and they're best for fresh eating versus storage. So that's, I guess, my opinion there. Okay. I don't know if you can change it once you've harvested it and they taste bitter, they're probably going to stay that way.
Yeah, and carrots are technically a cool season crop. So when we get the really hot weather in the summer, that can affect them and cause them to be bitter. So making sure that they're well watered will help as well, because that tends to keep the soil a little bit cooler and kind of prevents them from building up some of these compounds, these terpenoids in there that make them bitter. So planting now, and as Kevin said, so that they're actually growing and developing in the cooler fall might help you out a lot. Again, keeping them watered. And another thing is, if you harvest them too early, younger carrots haven't really developed their sugars yet. So sometimes if you're, you know, harvesting them in the heat of summer, they tend to be more bitter as well.
Lots of good things there. Thank you both for the, those responses. Kevin Shesso and Diana Alfeth, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Shesso, Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, and Diana Alfeth, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Lots of callers online. Let's go to the phones. Chris in Rice Lake, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. How's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, I got a problem in my lawn. It's been coming on for a couple of years now, and this year has just been absolutely awful, but it's Poa annua. I put a pre-emergent on early in the spring, and it didn't seem to really do anything. I've tried Tenacity now that it's up, and it seems to work okay, but I've got like 2 acres. So I'm wondering, what should I put another pre-emergent down in the fall, and what's the latest that I should do that?
You know how high you're cutting your grass? Is it 3-4 inches?
It's about 3.25 inches.
Okay.
And it's not all, it's not like super thick. It's like in some spots it's really nice and thick and some other spots it's not. But this Poa annua is gradually taking over my lawn.
Okay.
Yeah. So Poa annua is basically annual bluegrass as opposed to the perennial bluegrass that most of us have in lawns. And it looks different. And so it's technically a weed. So the problem is that some Poa annua is not just annua. It's become a little bit more perennial. And so it's difficult to get it all under control. But you're right, using a pre-emergent is a good thing to do, and reapplying it in early fall, like August through September, does also have some effect on it. And getting back to Larry's comment, if you're mowing your lawn at 3 1/4 inches, I would crank that mower deck up to 4 inches. I think everybody should put their mower deck at 4 inches. The taller your grass is, not only your grass is going to be healthier. So think about the more blade there is up above ground, the more photosynthesis that plant can do, which means the bigger root system it can grow. Taller grass is healthier grass, and it also helps to keep out weeds, and your Poa annua is a weed. So when it's taller, it's shaded at the soil surface. And just like we were talking about earlier, a seed needs soil contact in order to germinate. So by the time that Poa annua seed is down at the soil stuff, if it's in the darker shade, it's less likely to germinate because Poa likes full sun. So taller grass is more drought tolerant, more weed resistant. So yes, another dose of pre-emergent here in August through early September could help with it. And otherwise I would raise that mower deck.
All right. There you go, Chris. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Julie.
I was just going to remind listeners that, you know, the internet's a wonderful thing if you know how to find information that, you know, gives you the good intel, right? So, you know, if you do an internet search on Poa annual, extension or Wisconsin extension or, lawn maintenance or low input lawn maintenance extension, there is all kinds of fact sheets and websites related to the things that Diana mentioned, as far as just, you know, making sure you're following the cultural practices to make that Poa be outcompeted. And of course, there's all kinds of, you know, chemical options that are listed too that you might try if you're so inclined. So just a reminder, the internet can be useful in some of these situations as well.
Yep, if you go to the right sources. There you go. Julie in Fond du Lac, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Julie.
Hi, thanks so much for the show. It's really great information. I have a couple of questions, actually, and the first should be pretty simple. It's just, of course, like everybody else, I have a bunch of dead elm trees that we're going to need to take down, and I'm wondering if it's safe to use the wood chips that come from it.
Oh, as a mulch?
Mm-hmm, right.
So it depends on what the tree died from. In most cases, yes, it's safe to use the wood chips. Unless the tree died from, and I mentioned this disease earlier, it's called verticillium wilt, and it's a fungus disease that gets into the tree's vascular system and it plugs it up, and that's why the tree dies back, because the water can't get to the top of the tree and the sugars and energy from the leaves can't get down to the roots. It's not a super common disease, but it's also not uncommon. So if your trees died from drought or emerald ash borer or, you know,
Dutch elm.
Even Dutch elm is not a problem.
Okay.
Because Dutch elm disease is spread from a diseased tree to a live tree by insects. And insects aren't going to feed on wood chips. So if you have any reason to think that your tree died from verticillium wilt, then that disease can stay in those wood chips for at least 6 months. And if you mulch around healthy plants with that, you can infect your healthy plants because it gets into the soil and then it gets up into the shrubs and trees. So if it's not verticillium wilt that killed it, you can use those wood chips. If it is verticillium wilt, then you shouldn't.
All right. And Julie, does that help?
Yes. And if I could, I have another question. I have a new kind of weed that I hadn't seen before pop up in a couple of small patches. A neighbor of mine who does actually has a land management business, identified it as Roundup resistant water hemp. And I guess it's been a terrible problem. So I wondered what advice your guests have for that. Thank you.
Well, you can thank our food production system for this one if it is indeed the glyphosate-resistant weeds. We have known about herbicide-resistant weeds in our agricultural fields for many, many years now, and it's unfortunately, you know, the unintended consequences of, you know, of applying these products year after year, and plants, you know, they evolve and they figure out ways to become resistant. So once those seeds are out in the environment and now, you know, you don't have that option if you're so inclined. Now, we typically don't go out of our way to say, spray this, spray that. You know, it's up to you to decide if herbicides are in, you know, in your future for management options. But certainly if you do use glyphosate, that's, you know, not going to do a thing to this plant. So now you're back to just, you know, the cultural methods and cultural control, and just say, you know what, I just got to kill this plant the old-fashioned way. And I say use, if you're inclined, the Christmas herbicide. Do you know what that is? It's called Ho Ho Ho. But right. Okay. So there's other methods to get rid of this weed other than a herbicide. So I would say, you know, do everything you can to prevent this from going to seed, because those seeds now are going to cause, you know, be spread in the environment. And now people who are inclined to use herbicides aren't going to be able to kill it either. So we want to stop these weeds from spreading in our, you know, in our lawns or wherever they're showing up. So, yeah, if you can eradicate them by hand, you know, throw them in a trash bag and cook them, or, you know, put them in the garbage, that's probably the best thing to do.
Yeah. And water hemp is an annual, I believe. So if you can just keep them from going to seed, all of the plants that you see this year will die over winter. So it is one you can get under control.
Just make sure you get them cut down before they go to seed.
Right. And it's more of a concern for farmers who are using Roundup Ready crops. And so when the resistant water hemp gets in there, they can't control them. But usually in a home landscaping setting, you can get it under control without the use of herbicide.
Julie, there you go. Thank you so much. Let's go to Nels in Benton. Hi, Nels.
Hi. My question, we've got a raised garden. It's three sections that are 3 foot by 12 foot. And we're having some problems with our tomatoes. When I refresh the garden every year with compost from our yard grass. And when we plant the tomatoes, we put newspaper down around them. And then I cover the newspaper in the ground with fresh grass cuttings.
Yeah.
So what we're getting is some black spots on the lower leaves, and the branch that those black spots on the leaves are on will eventually die and just pop off. Now, we've been keeping those out of the garden. I was just kind of wondering what that could be, because we're trying to keep the dirt from splashing up on them.
Yeah.
So what kind of watering system do you use? Do you use an overhead sprinkler, or do you use a soaker hose, or you just water at the base of the plants, or how do you water?
We water at the base of the plants, usually with a hose.
Okay. So, Kevin, what do you think? Maybe a little septoria going on?
Well, this is where it kind of gets back to this whole horticulture CSI thing. I mean, we got to do our due diligence and try to figure out who our suspects are in this, and positive identification of the symptoms you're seeing on those plants are key. You know, as Diane mentioned, septoria leaf spot and early blight are by far the two most common diseases, but they typically follow this, you know, the wilting and yellowing, and there's yellow spots and black dots and, you know, other things that are pretty characteristic of those two diseases. So I would start with, you know, trying to look at pictures online, if you can, of some of our common tomato diseases. And if it's not early blight or septoria, you know, it could be another disease that might not even be similar. It could be a bacterial spot or speck. Those are some diseases that sometimes show up on our plants. And, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, how confident you are in what that disease is. If you can self-diagnose it by looking at pictures, or as we've mentioned earlier, you can always send a sample into our disease diagnostic clinic, and then you know for sure what you're dealing with. And that makes it a lot easier to figure out, okay, how do I manage this this disease, especially if it's reoccurring and it's causing problems, and you can always rotate away from that bed and plant your tomatoes someplace else and see if that doesn't clean up the soil. It might be a year or two of not planting tomatoes in that raised bed.
All good pieces of advice from our guest today, Kevin Schesso, the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, and Diana Alfuth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests Diana Alfuth and Kevin Schesso, talking about midsummer weeds, vegetables you can plant now to harvest in the fall. Hope you'll join in with your gardening questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Pam and Kellogg has a question for you, so let's go there. Pam, hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call.
I actually have two questions. I forgot to mention my second one. I'm wondering, my tomatoes in my garden, I already have tomatoes on. I'm thinking when you do something in a container, it must need more fertilizer. When I started it, I put Osmocote on both, but the one in the container is still blooming and there's no tomatoes. So is Osmocote, it's a slow release, but, and it also says that you shouldn't add another fertilizer with it. So can you explain that a little?
Well, I'll give it a try here. You know, obviously, when we're in a container, we do need to think about, you know, leaching of nutrients out of containers because we're constantly watering them and they have a drainage hole and whatnot. So that's why we need to spoon feed them or think about how we're going to provide season long fertility. And Osmocote is just that. It's like a poly coated prill or capsule of fertilizer. Sometimes it's a blend, or sometimes it's more high nitrogen. And whenever we see, plants not, so you said they're flowering, but they haven't set fruit yet.
Right.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it could be that they're just behind, you know, for whatever reason. Tomatoes are self-pollinating, so a bumblebee comes along or the wind, and they typically will set fruit once you have the flower. So, I don't see that the fertilizer should have any impact on that at this point. If we over-fertilize, we can sometimes get real leggy, tall plants, and they tend to have fewer flowers than not. And if you're seeing adequate flowering, I would say it's just a matter of time before those get pollinated and you start seeing fruit. So I don't think the Osmocote should have any impact on that.
And I'm wondering, are they both the same variety of tomato? Because some varieties will take longer than others.
Well, the one in the container, I think, is the one that's the cherry tomato. And so logically, I would have thought it would have fruited first, but that's not the case.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you'd have expected that.
Usually the plants develop and mature more in relation to the heat and the weather and the temperature versus the fertility levels. So I'm just wondering if it's just a variety difference as well, and they'll catch up, as Kevin said.
Yep, there you go, Pam. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Bonnie and Wanakee emailed and wondered, she's noticed a couple of striped cucumber beetles on her cucumber vines. She wonders if there's an organic spray to use on them. I was trying to think.
Off the top of my head, I don't know if there is. There probably is. I'd have to go online and search and find a good resource for that. So, again, if you typed in cucumber beetles, you know, with extension or some .edu in there, you would get a university website that has all the details about the life cycle and control and management options of cucumber beetles. But I don't know, Diane, if you have anything off the top of your head.
Organic? There's a compound called spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D, and it controls adult beetles, including cucumber beetles, and it is considered organic. It might be a little hard to find on your local store. You might need to order it online, but that would probably be the best bet for the adult beetles at this point.
All right. Let's go to Jan in Sugar Camp. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I have a small garden, and unfortunately, I can only fit one zucchini plant in there, although I like more. And in the past years, and this year included, I get beautiful yellow blossoms, but no fruit. So I did some research and talked to a few gardeners and farmers, and they told me about the problem with bees and not as much pollination. So I actually went online and I read and researched how to pollinate myself with a little paintbrush from a male to a female blossom. But my question is, why do I get like 12 male blossoms and maybe through the course of the year only two females? Do I need to have two plants? Do I need to do something else? Why is that?
Okay.
So what kind of plant was this again?
Zucchini.
Okay. So they typically just produce more male flowers than females. They're trying to provide a big source of pollen for the bees and stuff. Especially early in the season, they usually produce male flowers before they produce female flowers. And why they biologically do that, you know, the guess is that the plants are trying to bring the pollinators into the area before they bother sending out the female flowers. But that's not uncommon, and that's one of the reasons why if people eat, like, squash blossoms, you pick the males and not the females, but you usually have more male flowers than female flowers.
Yeah, it could also be an environmental, condition, too, because, you know, plants respond to their environment, and we've talked about that before. So it could be that maybe they're a little more stressed. Maybe they're not watered quite enough. So that could also, you know, cause the plant to delay the setting of female flowers. And it's very typical to see those. I always say the guys always show up early, right? And they wait for the girls to appear. But it's always delayed. And it could be that the plant is just not ready to produce those female flowers. And if it's maybe a water issue or maybe a maturity issue or other stresses, that could be going on here too. So maybe just up the watering and, you know, see if you can't keep those plants as happy as possible.
There you go, Jan. Thank you so much. Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota, I think had a second question for us. She was talking about growing Brussels for the first time. Pam, hi.
Hi, I've grown about every plant there is, but Brussels sprouts I've never done. So I thought I'd try that this year. And
I seem to remember hearing something about they're bitter until it freezes, or is that correct?
I would say yes.
Yeah.
Now, again, this is another classic fall crop. It takes a long time to grow those little fruitlets that are at the base of the stems. And we typically don't see those of any size until we get into fall. The plant will take a light frost, no problem. And I think, again, just like a lot of plants, they respond to their environment. And when we get those chilling temperatures down into, the upper 20s, low 30s even, they can sweeten up. So I try not to, and I usually don't have Brussels sprouts to pick until late September and into October. So I let mine go as long as possible, and that's usually after we've had our first killing frost before I harvest them. So that's what I do.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. Pam, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Kevin, as long as we have you here, there's an online course, Growing and Caring for Plants in Wisconsin. I think you're involved in that.
Well, again, this is part of our UW Extension Horticulture Program, and we've made a pretty concerted effort to, go more online and have that as an option for some of our outreach and educational opportunities. So we've got this online course. It's called Growing and Caring for Plants in Wisconsin, Foundations in Gardening. It's an online course that you need to register for. Registration is open starting Monday, July 18th, and it closes August 15th. I believe there's a cap. I'm not sure what that is. I'm sure it's more than six people because it's online. But it's really a very in-depth garden class. And it also then is what we use to get people who might want to become master gardener volunteers for Extension. So this is why we call it Foundations in Gardening, because it really covers the basics. It's very similar to what we used to teach face-to-face or in different ways through our master gardener training. So there's a link, I believe, that was shared in the show notes.
Yes.
If you want a very comprehensive, almost college level kind of gardening class, you might want to check that out.
Yeah. If you go to ideas at WPR.org/Larry and go to today's date and then just look under program notes, you're going to find that information about the online course. So good information there. Also, I wanted to mention that the Madison area Iris Society is having its iris sale going on actually today and tomorrow. The sale's at the West Ag Research Station on Mineral Point Road in Madison from 9 to 5, both today and tomorrow. Probably had a little wet morning at the Ag Research Station on Mineral Point Road, but that's the Iris Society's sale this year. So mention that as well. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Lots of emails. Sharon sent us an email about squash borer. She says try to plant nasturtiums directly in the hill with the squash seeds to deter or repel borers. She's done this for years, she says. And I don't know if there's any truth to that, but it apparently has worked for her. John sent an email. We here on this show, it was suggested some years ago to plant radishes around your vine crops to prevent vine borers. And John thinks that works as well. So there's another bit of information. And let's see, what else have we got? I don't know if you guys have access to the photos. Tim from Genesee Depot sent us this picture. He's wondering what it is and identify the plant, I believe.
So when I first look at that picture, my question I would ask him is, if he sticks it to his clothes, does it stick? Because it looks like catchweed bedstraw to me. That's my first guess. And otherwise, we'd probably have to get some more close-up pictures to be absolutely sure.
Okay. Jocelyn in West Bend sent an email. Is there any benefit to thinning or pruning zucchini, summer squash plants? Jocelyn heard of people thinning some of the leaves out, but she hasn't tried it.
So, Kevin, I don't know if you've ever heard of anything, but I think you want as many leaves there as possible for doing photosynthesis, feeding the plant, also shading the developing fruits, because if they're exposed to the sun, especially the summer squash, they can scorch and get heat damage. On the other hand, increasing air circulation could help if you have like powdery mildew issues, which is a fungal disease that likes high humidity. And, you know, probably a better thing is to trellis vine crops for reducing humidity. So I don't know. I mean, there might be a little bit of benefit from decreasing humidity, but you got to be careful you don't overdo it.
Yeah,
right. And this is a classic example of, you know, we get a little bit over excited when we're planting, and maybe we plant, you know, too many in a small space. Because you know how vines go. I mean, that little seedling can take up, you know, 3-4 square, you know, a 3-foot, 4-foot diameter circle. And if you got too many plants crammed together, you know, that's just not ideal. So like you said, Diana, there's reason to thin and open up if it's detrimental to the overall health of the plant. But in general, I typically don't do much in the way of pruning on vines, unless you gotta say, hey, you know, you gotta stay in this spot here, we're gonna cut this off, and you know, because you're running out of space.
Chad sent us an email. He owns property in Sawyer County. He's noticed many large 200 to 300 year old white pines dying throughout the forest. He has a very large white pine on his property and wants to know what he can do to protect it from dying. Are there sprays or injections to combat whatever is plaguing the white pine population?
Well, it's a Sawyer County call, so I feel obligated to take it. And I've, just like you, Diane, we get these calls every once in a while. What do I do with this prized landscape tree? You know, it's been there for maybe 100 or more years. And, you know, you see what's going on in the local environment. And yes, you know, we do have things that cause pine trees to die. White pine blister rust is one of the more common ones. And again, you know, we need to acknowledge that, you know, these trees do end up dying for whatever reason, whether it's environmental, like the drought stress we've mentioned. And Diane did that little, you know, preview on how to think about, you know, what's causing your tree to go into decline. But we really need to probably enlist the help of a certified arborist when we talk these large landscape trees, doing a site investigation, getting somebody who has knowledge of tree health, and then deciding whether or not it warrants any kind of management, you know, preventative, you know, things. You know, a healthy plant is going to be able to stave off diseases and insects. And, you know, again, if it's in an environment where there's been some compaction around the roots or root pruning or anything that's going to stress those older trees, we want to, you know, do what we can to keep those trees happy. So I would say if you can find an arborist through the Wisconsin Arborist Association, have somebody come out, take a look at that tree, and just give their assessment of it and kind of go from there. But large trees are really challenging to manage just because of their size, and you can't really get up into the canopy and investigate very easily. So I like to leave it to the pros.
Bill in Green Bay sent us an email. He has snow on the mountain in with his peonies in flocks, how can he remove the snow on the mountain without screwing up the peonies in the flocks?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Snow in the mountain is kind of cute, but it's very invasive and it's really hard to get rid of. And honestly, you're going to have to just kind of dig it out. And keep in mind that, like a lot of plants, the roots have a lot of energy stored in them. So if you just break it off at ground level, those roots will resprout. But if you keep breaking it off at ground level, even over and over, you can eventually starve out those roots if you don't let the leaves come back and do photosynthesis and replenish that energy. You know, and you can always, you can use herbicides if you're so inclined. Broadleaf weed killers do work on it, as does glyphosate. And you just have to spot spray and get it on those leaves and not on your peonies or other things. But really, in most cases, it's best in a situation like that if you just do some diligent digging it out. And hopefully at some point you can get it under control. It's a tough one.
Tony and Custer sent an email. Curious if you've read Weeds. The book Weeds and What They Tell Us, it was written in the 70s. The idea is that certain weeds are growing to correct a soil or ecology imbalance, leaving the thought that herbicides not only kill the plant, but also the biology associated with them and their system, exasperating the issue later. Wonders about composting the weeds can help correct some issues in soil with annuals and perennials to be physically removed to allow another ecology to take over.
So there are lots of theories about what weeds tell us, and they do tell us certain things. So for example, if you have plantain growing in your lawn, it probably means your soil is compacted there, and you know, you can spray them out with herbicides all you want. If you don't improve the compaction, you are going to get plantain back there. So I'm not so sure that plantain moves in to correct the compaction situation, because I don't think it does, but it's just more adapted to that situation. So, but also, you know, weeds, they do have benefits. They have deep root systems that can add organic matter to the soil after they die. They have as they grow and die, they can recycle nutrients just like any other plant and stuff. So I think there's some good things about weeds as well.
On that happy note, we will say thank you to Kevin and Diana. Thank you both very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Kevin Chiasso, the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. And Diana Alfeth, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Great to have them with us. They'll be back, and we'll talk with them again. It's always fun to have them with us. Next Friday on Garden Talk, we'll focus on growing vegetables without chemicals. And on Monday, our physical therapy experts are back to talk about all kinds of things and, of course, take your questions as well. That's Monday on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.